Welcome back to this week's Fear or Favour, another packed week. And this week we're going to look at a number of different issues. Again, we're going to look at the Tory MP who was caught watching pornography on his phone in the House of Commons. Also, we're going to update in relation to the Duke of York, and he's had his freedom of the City of York removed. And the very tragic case of Ricky Neave, who was killed in 1994, and it's taken all that time to finally bring someone to justice. We're going to look at Madeleine McCann, and of course we'll talk about the programme that I've got coming out very shortly, and the very interesting conviction of Boris Becker, who will, by the time this is being listened to, have been sentenced. Nazir, how are you?
I'm good, thank you, Mark. We always do basically anything that comes to mind. I mean, we've got a real hotspot today, but I'm absolutely fine. It's been a really busy week, as it always is, but I'm delighted to be talking to you.
So what do you think about this MP? So the report is that it's come out as a result of a claim by one female Conservative MP, and that's now been supported by another Conservative MP who also says that she saw the same MP watching pornography in the Commons. And as I understand it, this is MP sat in the Commons and from a different observing point, two other MPs were able to see him.
Yes. Well, what can you say? I mean, look, if somebody's watching pornography in the workplace, if in your police station or in my office, I would immediately suspend them. I would investigate it, and if it was proved, they would be dismissed. You know, I can't imagine that this should be treated any differently. I mean, there have been lots of excuses. One that I heard was that actually he wasn't watching porn. He'd left his tabs open from the night before, and he accidentally clicked on one of those tabs. Whatever the reality of it is that you can't – I mean, what we have – surely we have higher expectations. No, I don't even want higher expectations. I want the same expectations of members of parliament as you would do of any other anybody in a workplace.
But isn't that the problem, Nazir? Isn't that the problem? Because we can't sack an MP, can
no,
we?
No, there's a standards, as I understand it, the professional standards department, in effect, of the parliamentary standards will look at it and then they'll investigate it. And then the Prime Minister has said that his personal view is that it should be grounds for dismissal. But of course, you can't just dismiss an MP. They have to resign or they have to be recalled by their constituents. And then, so there's a process that one has to go through, which will prolong this agony. The fact is that, you know, there were members of, so it's not party political, there were members of his own party that observed what they say they saw. There's no reason to suggest that they are not telling the truth. And it, in the context of the fact that we've learned that 56 members of parliament are being investigated for sexual harassment right now, should we say it again, 56, 9%. Of our parliamentarians are currently being investigated for sexual harassment, tells you something about the culture that exists in Parliament. Somebody said to me, oh, they get this really boring there. I don't care whether it's boring or not. I'm afraid sexual harassment is sexual harassment wherever it may be.
There's a very interesting climate, I think, that exists within the House of Commons. It's almost as though once you walk through that door into the building, it becomes another world. It becomes
there are different rules that apply. I mean, obviously, we know the rule about, for example, you can't call somebody a liar in Parliament, even if they've lied several times. Additionally, there is the parliamentary privilege. So an MP standing up in the House of Commons can say that Mark is this and Nazir is that, and there's nothing you and I could do about that. Mm. So there are very distinct and very separate rules. These are our lawmakers, and we understand that. I mean, going back historically, you know, the reason why we have a parliament is because the king at the time wanted to try and interfere with the way government was being run. So we have to have rules that ensure the independence of parliament. But it is a workplace. Hundreds, if not thousands, of people work in that environment, and they should be treated in exactly the same way, with the same respect as well as the same disrespect when they've offended or misbehaved.
We say that politicians should be treated the same as everybody else in the workplace. But the reality is they are utterly unique. There is no other job that I know of where you can't discipline or sack somebody, or you can't sack somebody without that going back to either constituents or they resign.
There is one other, and we're going to talk about it later. It's called the Royal Family. Absolutely. When it comes to Parliament, there's a reason for that, is that, you know, parliamentarians should be able to act without fear or favour. And therefore, if they are being pilloried and castigated and whatever it is, but they also have standards, or they should have. And if they misbehave, they should face the same wrath that you and I would face. And I think nobody could probably argue with that. You know, the reality is, we discussed previously about the MP that was convicted of sexual abuse. We learned this week that MP, Imran Khan, was also on the government's anti-grooming committee. Well, for crying out loud. Absolutely. They knew at that time, because an allegation had been made to the Conservative Party before the trial, and yet they still put him on the anti-grooming committee when he was suspected of and ultimately convicted of
grooming. And that is very worrying. You know, the politicians, and we see it in other hierarchied elements of business, where they absolutely look after each other. They, you know, they shelter each other. They pat each other's back. And I have to say, when I heard that news that he was on the committee that was ultimately responsible for creating the legislation that sits around the grooming, and they would have had knowledge of a complaint being made. That is truly shocking. You know, at the very least, in any other environment, you would remove that individual from it.
Do you know, I've not heard anybody give any justification for it. I wondered if they were going to say, look, he's actually an expert on grooming. That's why we put him on the committee. You know?
Yeah. That would be true, wouldn't it?
It would be, wouldn't it? Exactly. I really don't know what, I mean, as you say a moment ago, they are rules, they are law unto themselves, literally, and they operate in ways that you and I perhaps, well, not perhaps, would think, you know, need to be subject to the same rules that everybody else does. We've discussed before, you know, they seem to think the law doesn't apply to them, they seem to think the rules don't apply to them, they think they're better than us, and, you know, time and time again, we come across individuals like the ones that we've talked about today and others that really bring Parliament into disrepute. And, you know, I think maybe it's time to have a look at the process by which MPs are allowed to be MPs. You know, we talked before about police vetting. There's no vetting for MPs. And, not, you know, they can stand whoever they want to can stand. And nobody gives a proverbial as to whether they've got previous convictions or whether there's any intelligence or whatever it might be about their behaviour. But if they misbehave, then they ought to be the full force of the law on them, and the consequences. Well, you know, we need to restore confidence in Parliament, and they're simply destroying it.
One other thing, and we are going to talk about this at some stage. We haven't had the chance really to dissect it, and I think we probably get a guest in when we talk about this. This is the sheer prevalence now of pornography, and, you know, pornography over the years has changed in the way that it's viewed. Obviously, historically, it was viewed by magazines and videos. You know, the kind of like the shops that you would go to up in Soho or in some of the major cities. Of course, now it's so readily available online, and available without any payment. So it is now simply a click away. And and obviously, yeah, people do watch pornography, and that's entirely a matter for them. But when it infects your work, or when it's an impact to other people who may not have the same views in relation to that, that is when, of course, it becomes worrying. And I, taking that to another level, and something that we will talk about, is it worries me the amount of pornography now that exists, and what impact that has on the younger brain. You know, as an adult, you can deal with it very differently.
As you said, accessibility is completely altered. I remember back there's some research that says in 1985, I'm talking specific about indecent images of children. In 1985, there were about 7,500 indecent images of children in circulation. That's all, because it was DVDs, etc., you know, or not even DVDs, videos. But in one of the last cases I dealt with when I was prosecuting, the man had 2.5 million on his computer. So in a space of, I don't know, 25, 30 years, you've gone to the billions of images rather than the low thousands. And as you say, accessibility on a computer, on a phone, on any device now, you can access this kind of material. As you say, I mean, we're not going to have this conversation today, but there are some people who think that just pornography itself is degrading. It's a sort of conveyor belt. It leads people to more serious offending, et cetera, et cetera. It damages, gender equality, all those kinds of things. I have a lot of sympathy for that. But what we're talking about here is pornography in the workplace. We're talking about indecent images of children, potentially. We're talking about those types of things where we know that there is harm and harm is created. And, I don't know what the answer is. I mean, this is a worldwide phenomenon. You can't simply deal with it in the UK without looking at what Europe and the rest of the world is doing. But the availability now is really, really painful to think about. And I don't have any answers, I'm afraid. I just don't know what we can do to stem the tide.
And I think it is interesting when you look at the amount of child abuse images that exist. And I did obviously an awful lot about this when I was in the police. And I remember doing a lot of work around looking at where child abuse images really came from. And I think one of the interesting elements, so if you go back to the 1970s, child abuse very much grew from Scandinavian countries. And in fact, so much so that there was this creation of Lolitots, Lolita as magazines. And the company that was producing it in Scandinavia it was Denmark. And they said to the authorities in Denmark, we want to produce these magazines which have children in. And the authorities said to them, and this is truly shocking, said to them, well, that's fine as long as it doesn't involve children of this country. So right. It can involve children of another country. And right. That was really the creation of it. And then if you go back to the 70s and early 80s in relation to the UK, there was a massive influx of child abuse images coming in through Soho. And what we know, of course, in the 1970s was a huge corruption within the Metropolitan Police of the vice squads that existed yes. in Soho, and so much so that they turned a blind eye. And what ended up happening was that many of those sex shops held child abuse material under the counter. So you would be able to go in and actually ask for that material. And you look at the likes of Robert Black, the serial killer, Robert yeah. Black, child serial yeah. killer. I mean, he was utterly addicted to child abuse material, and he got his actually from France.
I mean, as you say, there is a stream of cases that we can talk about where, there's clearly that their gateway to offending was pornography. Particularly pornography involving children. And therefore, we've got to find a mechanism by which we identify these people, prevent them from causing harm. I mean, I take issue with the fact that pornography started in the 70s. You know, there are images in the hieroglyphs and there are images in ancient Greece.
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to the ancient times, but large-scale production really
no, you're absolutely right. The fact that it was, as you say, it went from magazines, it went to videos and DVDs and the like. It's now in the digital sphere. God, we've talked before about virtual reality. It is now, I don't know, an epidemic. And I think maybe we can invite some experts on to a future podcast so we can actually have a think about what it is.
And I think it's an interesting debate. I don't know the answer to this because I don't have children of school age, but I wonder what's done within schools to talk and discuss pornography, because I think this is one of the taboo areas. It's an area that people feel quite uncomfortable talking about. Parents feel uncomfortable about talking to their children. And it's an area that I suspect many teachers feel incredibly uncomfortable about talking. I wonder how much is done about it.
Well, I mean, they have citizenship classes, and I imagine that they have some classes about this, or some talks about this. But, people feel quite embarrassed talking about this. And I can't imagine that teachers would be any less embarrassed than you and I having a conversation with children or young people about this. As strange as they may sound, they probably know more about it than we do. They've accessed it, they've seen it, they know what's out there, and we're trying to say to them that don't do it. I think we've got a broader conversation we have to have around equalities, around we said earlier on about the journey that some offenders take from indecent images that ends up in them harming people. We've got to have a very deep conversation about this. I think I'm actually keen that we ought to have a future podcast dedicated to this subject where we bring on a couple of experts, because let's try and think of some solutions. And again, we encourage our listeners to let us have their solutions so we can actually start informing government. Because whenever I have any conversation with the Home Office about this over the years, they too are struggling to come up with solutions.
Right. Well, let's park that for now. The Duke of York, he's been at it again in terms of him coming back into the news.
Allegedly.
Stripped of the freedom of City of York. What do you think about that? I mean, he has absolutely fallen from total, you know, position of grace. He is now persona non grata. Well, look, he's on his way.
If I'd paid £12 million to a woman that I never met before for something I'd never done, I think I'd be open to criticism. The City of York, after which his title has been generated, the local councils have taken a view. They do not think that him giving him the freedom of the city is quite appropriate, given what's happened and what's become aware of in recent years. And that's entirely a democratic decision, entirely up to them. The York is not seen. I've been to York a few times. I'm sure you have too. It's not a lefty, liberal, anti-royalist city. So the fact that the City of York has taken this step should be quite worrying, actually, to the Duke and to his advisors, because it's become very much mainstream that people do not want to associate themselves with him. I mean, if there was another Duke of York and it wasn't him, I'm pretty sure they'd be happy with that. But, you know, he still remains Duke of York. He just doesn't have the freedom of the City of York, whatever that amounts to. Probably being able to carry a few sheep through the city centre, I think, is how generally kind of thing you get when you get freedom of the city. It's quite telling, isn't it, that he's tried to rehabilitate himself in the immediate aftermath of the settlement, and here's another blow to that. We've got the Queen's 70th anniversary celebrations coming up soon. There was talk of, if you remember, at Prince Philip's memorial, the Queen, or he made sure that he was walking the Queen down the aisle, not the aisle, but, you know, you get my point. And additionally, there's talk that he might have center space at the 70th anniversary, platinum anniversary. I'm just a little bit concerned about that. You know, rehabilitation, you need to earn rehabilitation. It shouldn't be something that's given to you on a plate. And the City of York have made their views very clear about what they think of him.
So let's move on. This is a tragic case. This is the case of Ricky Neave, 6 years old in 1994. He disappeared after leaving home for school. His body was later discovered in undergrowth. It's taken years, three decades, to finally bring his killer to justice. Ricky Neave's body was found naked, posed star-shaped, with his arms outstretched and his legs wide apart, in the wooded area by his Welland Estate home in Peterborough in November 1994. Initially, and for a considerable period of time, the police suspected Ricky's mother, Ruth, who was prosecuted and jailed for child cruelty for a period of 7 years, but she was acquitted on the charge of murder. The Assistant Chief Constable met with the family, and he, I think, has been quite remarkable in his doggedness to take this case on, and actually was very forthright. And he said, "I thought the original hypothesis around her, that being the mother, being responsible was fanciful at best. And then the more I looked at it, the more I was convinced actually we needed to look into it further." So James Watson has now been found guilty of murdering young Ricky. But it took so long. He was part of the initial investigation in 1994, and they utterly dismissed every element that linked him to the murder of Ricky. Terrible.
Yeah, I mean, what's trouble? I mean, lots of things are troubling about this. The fact that, you know, James Watson was 13 at the time, did they think, well, a child couldn't have done this? Well, it was only a year or two after Jamie Bulger was murdered by two children. So surely that can't have been on their minds. I can't believe that. They focused entirely on the mother. That, sadly, is a common occurrence. You know, tunnel vision. You have one suspect, you focus on that one suspect, you don't think about anything else. So it was poorly policed at the outset. Poor Ricky was from a very deprived family. There's evidence that he was stealing to feed his own family, and at the age of six, you know, it was horrible upbringing and terrible death. There's something ritualistic about the way he was murdered and the way he was left, as you say, in a star shape. Which I think immediately would have made me think, hang on a minute, that's not what a mother does. But anyway, there were lots of mistakes made at the outset. Let's focus, if we will, for a moment on the success, because you mentioned the Assistant Chief Constable, former Assistant Chief Constable, who became extraordinarily resilient and determined to deliver justice because he knew there was something not right. And, you know, time had passed, lots of forensic evidence had disappeared. They found little bits of evidence that linked them to James Watson. DNA was available in 1994, but it clearly wasn't used. But DNA was used, which linked Watson to the murder scene. And there was other evidence that came to light. So a proper, really thorough investigation took place now, recently, because of the doggedness and determination of that particular officer and his team. And that is a real credit to them. Because, again, another thing you didn't mention was that initially the prosecutors said there wasn't enough evidence. And so he pursued that again and had what they called a victim's right to review, and they reviewed the decision and then brought the prosecution. So there's been loads of obstacles in the way of delivering justice in this case. But as it often takes, one individual or one group of people, including family of Ricky, who were determined that justice would be done, and finally it has been done. It's a terrible shame that it's taken 27, 28 years.
Yeah, absolutely. And Paul Forward was the former Assistant Chief Constable. He came back out of retirement to lead on this. And I have to say, I mean, we'll try and reach out to Paul Forward and see if he wants to come on, because I think his detail in terms of this case, it is one... I remember looking at it many, many years ago, and the view of so many people was that Mum was absolutely responsible and they were unprepared to listen to anything else. And even when it was screaming out to say, look, there's some pretty interesting evidence. I mean, one of the interesting points, and we can talk a little bit further about this, was that the Deputy Chief Crown Prosecutor for CPS said that we had evidence to show that he, being James, had killed a bird and laid it out, spread-eagled, in a manner perhaps reminiscent of how Ricky Nee's body was treated after his killing. Now, there was some work done some years ago which was putting a direct correlation between those that commit violent sexual attacks or physical attacks to those that also mutilate or attack animals.
I'm aware of that too. Very often you will see harm to pets and animals in the back history. We talked earlier on about pornography and extreme pornography and images of children being one area where you could look at to see, identify people who are potentially going to offend. Additionally, those who have shown, you know, terror towards pets and animals, there is evidence, as you say, that some of them will then go on to harm adults and harm human beings. And, we need to look for all of these triggers or all of these risks assessments. So in order to be able to identify those who are potentially going to harm us. And, you know, I can't believe that they did not know. I mean, as you say, the prosecution said that this is evidence they found. Well, that evidence would have been available back in 1994, would it not? So why did nobody think, hang on a minute, Watson has done this, and look at the, you know, he would, you know, look at how poor Ricky was left after he'd been murdered, you know, and did these sums, 2 + 2 = 4. Why did it take so long for somebody to actually look at this and explore this with the level and detail that it needed to be able to deliver justice? I feel obviously very ashamed, really, of a system that does prolong people's agony in this way.
Yeah, absolutely. And the statistics are quite interesting. So 16% is one report of individuals who commit violent offences, have committed offences against animals. And they say that a violent offender who is five times more likely to be someone who has committed offences against animals. Yeah. So there's a very interesting correlation there. And perhaps it's sometimes overlooked.
No, absolutely. I know this in domestic abuse as well. That you know, generally the perpetrator of domestic abuse will also be very, very nasty towards the pets of the family. So there's all sorts of opportunities here to prevent more serious harm if people firstly did some more research, secondly carried out proper risk assessments, looked at how animals were being treated by certain individuals in order to determine whether or not that puts them at greater risk of more serious harm. I think there is ample scope here for more work. I think the problem, of course, is that we haven't got enough resources, and we're being reactive left, right, and centre rather than being proactive in trying to identify these people before they commit harm.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think it is shocking, and there is definitely a direct correlation between the animal abuse and violent offenders. So back in the news, and it kind of really never leaves the news. Every single time there's the slightest interest around Madeleine McCann, it's plastered across the newspapers and in the headlines and worldwide as well. You know, having been over there and covered the story extensively within 72 hours, what amazed me, and having covered Oscar Pistorius as well, the worldwide stage, was the sheer interest that this case attracted. And before we talk about Madeleine's case in particular, I just want to look at the aspect of why is it, and I think we can talk in these terms, Peter Fahey, the former chief constable of Greater Manchester, who is a great guy, and you know, Peter used to be my governor when I was in Surrey, and he came out very clearly and said that if you are white, middle class, with a child, predominantly mainly a girl, you will receive far more publicity and attention than if you are a black boy having come from a council estate. Now, he didn't add the last bit. I'm adding that last bit to make the correlation between them both. But it's true, isn't it?
100%. Just this week, we've seen four black people murdered in a house in Bermondsey in southeast London. A man has been charged, so we can't say any more about the case itself. But was it front page of any newspaper? Was it covered in any respect, any detail whilst the inquiry was taking place? Has there been the vigils that we would expect? I imagine. I've not seen any. So for my part, absolutely, victims of colour get a short treatment, really, when it comes to this type of behaviour. If a young black girl had gone missing in Portugal, I don't imagine, I'll be honest with you, I don't imagine it would have got anything like the attention that Maddie McCann has had. Maddie McCann, there's also a class play here as well, isn't there? You know, Maddie's parents, are middle class, et cetera, et cetera. I imagine if it was a white working class girl, it probably wouldn't have got the same attention either. So you've got an interplay.
And what's so sad about that is that naturally informs the response of the police. And therefore, whilst it's media savvy friendly, it also means that the response of the police is reflective of the amount of media coverage. That was always the case.
We just talked about Ricky's murder. You know, I can't think of the sums. It's something like £14 million have now been spent on the investigation in relation to Maddie McCann's disappearance. £14 million? To prosecute one and investigate one murder in this country costs £1.5 million. That's the whole thing, from investigation, prosecution, etc. So we've spent 10 times that in trying to deliver justice in relation to poor Maddie McCann. Had it been somebody else, or, as you say, from a lower class or from a different background or heritage or whatever it may be, you know, and I know, I mean, it's a fact that it would not have got the level of resource or attention. It's troubling and worrying. You know, if my child had gone missing in Portugal, I don't imagine that the state would still be looking for him or her 20 years later.
No, and I think one of the things that really concerning was that the parents, rightfully so, of course, Jerry and Kate are always going to want as much done as possible. But they came out and very clearly said that the British government should be doing more, the British authorities should be doing more. There was a report prepared by CEOP at the time, the Child Exploitation Online Protection Centre, and that report was given to the Home Secretary. And basically, the recommendation was that the Metropolitan Police, whilst they could become involved, should not become involved. And the Home Secretary's position was very clearly, this is a crime that happened abroad. We cannot set a precedent in relation to taking these cases on. That was then referred to the Prime Minister. And the Prime Minister very clearly himself said, we will step in. We will give this to the Metropolitan Police and Operation Grange will commence and we will start our own investigation. Years down the road, many, many millions of pounds later, the sad reality is they are no further forward. And I use that in the terms is that I think, you know, you're not a little bit pregnant. You're pregnant or you're not pregnant. Yeah. Right. And it's the same in relation to Madeleine. You know, they are no further forward because there is nobody being charged and there was nobody's recovered her body or knows what's happened to it. So they haven't solved this case anywhere. They've spent millions of pounds. And when I look at the other cases that exist there of missing children out there, of murdered, unsolved cases, it is frustrating.
Yeah.
And I say this because obviously for Jerry and Kate, of course, they want as much money spent as possible. But I'm talking in terms of the other victims that are left without it. It's so unfair.
You know, Mark, not a month will go by without me being contacted by somebody from somewhere around the world saying that their loved one has gone missing or has been murdered and they think that somebody, they know who did it, and can the police in this country, it's usually a British system, can the police in this country investigate it? And, you know, whilst there are a few investigations conducted by the Met on behalf of the UK, there are very few, very few. And yet here is, as you say, no further forward. We do not know what happened to Maddie McCann. We do not have a suspect charged. And yet we have expended £14 million plus. And, you know, a little proportion of that being spent on some of these other crimes, which could ultimately have brought people to justice. Well, I can see why they're angry.
No, absolutely. So announced this week was that Christian B, and we'll use that because of the legislation tied up around his full name, but Christian B was now to be put as an aguido, so in other words, a suspect in relation to the disappearance of Madeleine by the Portuguese. So he was already been put forward by the German prosecutors 2 years ago as their suspect. And the Portuguese were now weighing in and saying that he was a suspect. What is interesting about that is in relation to potentially why that happened. So at a 15-year period, in relation to a crime in Portugal, it doesn't matter whether it's a homicide or whether it's child abuse, whatever it is. That 15-year period is a statute of limitation. Thereafter, unless there are proceedings in place, that 15 years means that you can't prosecute.
Yeah.
What is interesting is that they are, so therefore, the fact that they've made him a suspect, and let's work on the basis, the significance of that 15 years, it would mean that the Portuguese are also considering this as a homicide rather than a missing person.
Mm-hmm.
But take that one step further, which is, if she were a missing person and they were solely dealing with as a missing person, the legislation means that if she went missing and was still alive, that 15-year period doesn't start. It only starts from the point that she is dead. And I was talking this through actually with our amazing producer yesterday. And what's interesting is that imagine you as the offender are interviewed by the police and they say, well, we want to know when you killed her. And if he turned around, the offender turns around and says, well, I killed her the day after, that 15-year period would start the day after. But if they'd said, no, actually, it was a week's time or a month's time after that, that might still mean that actually they're within that 15-year period, which seems bizarre.
Yeah, it's putting all the onus on the suspect to determine whether or not he can be prosecuted. And you're absolutely right. I mean, I have no doubt that the 15-year statute of limitations has played a significant role in the decision to name this individual as a as a suspect, so to speak, because of that time limit. That's what's happening here, to give the impression that there are active proceedings. You know better than anybody else, given that you've been investigating this for a long time, whether or not there's sufficient evidence for this to happen. But it does strike me as a more of a bureaucratic move than anything else.
And I'll talk a little bit about kind of what my program gives and what we've done, but I just want to explore statute of limitations in the UK. So, yep. So there is a statute of limitation that exists around unlawful sexual intercourse, 12 months from the period of the time yep. that it's occurred. What other statute of limitations exist within the UK?
Well, the most basic ones are for what we would call summary only offences. So offences for which you can go to prison for no more than 6 months or 12 months in a magistrate's court, they have statute limitations. A prosecution has to be brought within 6 months of a crime having been committed. So, for your benefit, if you were speeding along the streets and the police took a picture of you doing so sent you a note saying that you ought to be, you need to identify who has been driving, et cetera, and 6 months pass before they are able to start proceedings against you, they cannot bring those proceedings because the six-month time limit applies. Not that I'm suggesting to anybody that they should try and avoid a speeding conviction. So there are very few. America has it too. We don't have many statute of limitations. That's why we can bring allegations of sexual abuse from 40, 50 years ago. That's why we talked earlier on about Ricky's murder 27 years later. We don't have statute of limitations broadly. They generally revolve around less serious offences in order to put some pressure on people to bring these cases to court rather than let them stand and remain outstanding, so to speak. So we have very few, Mark, and they tend to be less serious offences.
And I'm utterly shocked that Portugal, for example, and there are other countries, I'm sure, that has a statute of limitation in relation to homicide, so murder. And I was doing some work around it this week, and the suggestion that comes out of Portugal, and this isn't, we don't have anything to back this up, but in 2002, there was a huge scandal that involved very, very senior individuals in the establishment who were involved, as the story goes, in relation to the state-run Casa Pia orphanages. And what has come out of the inquiries that I made was that as a result of that, this statute of limitation was certainly pushed for and moved forward so that those individuals who may have had a very important cause couldn't be prosecuted.
Yeah, well, there you go. What can I say? There's always a bit of corruption behind some of these things, and that probably explains a lot. We don't have it here because we recognize that it doesn't matter how long ago something terrible happened. Somebody should be brought to justice, even if it does take 3 decades.
Yeah. So, I mean, in relation to Madeleine, I spent the summer in Germany and Portugal investigating, and we set out really to see whether or not Christian B was responsible for Madeleine's disappearance. Very clearly set out by the German prosecutors that he was, as far as they're concerned, and what's been portrayed in the media, was that on the evening of the 3rd of May 2007, Christian B was outside her apartment using a telephone and in communication with another person, and therefore he was in the vicinity within a matter of yards. We've looked at that and properly assessed, looking at all the evidence around that, whether or not that is the case. And what we have found out is some very...
Don't share spoilers.
No,
don't share
some spoilers. Some very different information in relation to that. And we've just explored him further in relation to, and it's been out there now, an alibi that he gives. And we've explored that alibi in detail for the very first time. And the revelations are quite fascinating. So 11th of May, 9 o'clock, 90-minute special on Channel 5. And it certainly is receiving an awful lot of interest. But naturally so, Madeleine is it's almost become a phenomenon in this country.
It is. You can go anywhere in this country and mention the name and they all have a view on it. Lots of terrible views, nonetheless, but they all have views on it. And I very much look forward to watching the programme. Well, 11th of May.
Brilliant. 11th of May. So Boris Becker is back in court, having been found guilty of 20 tax evasion allegations. And one of them involves £950,000 from the sale of a Mercedes dealership and also sale of properties and bank loans ranging from various different prices, including one bank loan of £700,000. I watched him. I went to watch him in Wimbledon, and what an amazing tennis player he was. He was a world-class player who provided excitement. He was around the time, you know, Jimmy Connors was coming to an end, McEnroe was there, and Borg was coming to an end. And he kind of came onto this stage as this young, if I remember rightly, 18-year-old, incredible German who was, you know, he was flair, he had the looks, and he just took Wimbledon by storm, didn't he?
Yeah. I mean, he was, I grew up around watching him. He had real personality. But yeah, he literally, blew the world. In a post-Connors, Borg world, suddenly this man turned up. He was 17 or something when he won his first titles, and he was absolutely extraordinary. And then he got a little bit more checkered, didn't he? I remember back in my mind, he ended up making somebody pregnant in a cupboard somewhere. I've got all sorts of myths about him that have been
It's amazing how certain things stick in your head, because as you were saying that, I was thinking, so since his Wimbledon years, I know Boris Becker for making someone pregnant in a broom cupboard.
That's what it was.
And, conceiving a child in a broom cupboard. And I think that's kind of become his notoriety until now, because he stood accused of concealing £945,000 in relation to the sale of a Mercedes dealership, and also in relation to hiding a £690,000 bank loan in relation to properties. This is mass tax evasion, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And he was obviously lots of creditors. He owes lots of money allegedly to people. And they wanted to know, they wanted the money. He's trying to hide the money from them. He's hiding the money from the tax man. It is, what can I say? I mean, it's one of those careers that will make a great movie one day, from the heights of Wimbledon to his downfall via the broom cupboard. I mean, it's quite an extraordinary fall from grace, and you can't be given a slap on the wrist for concealing that kind of money.
Yeah, I mean, over his career, he had earnings of over 38 million. He says that much of that was consumed by his divorce, but he's been found guilty now of 20 counts relating to bankruptcy.
Most of us in this country now begin to realize, hang on a minute, middle class, white collar crime isn't treated very seriously. If you steal 50 quid's worth of sweets from a shop, you go to prison. If you steal 50 million, they give you a slap on the wrist. I think people are beginning to expect now that sort of criminality should get a prison sentence. It's about deterrence. How else do you prevent people from concealing money, from avoiding, evading tax liabilities, et cetera, unless you send out a deterrent criminal punishment?
Yeah, it's one of those crimes, isn't it? White collar crime that always seems to be forgotten and people get away with it. But yeah, I think it is slowly started to be prosecuted more. And I think when you've got the likes of someone as high profile as him, it does focus the attention again.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, historically, people like Ken Dodd, he was prosecuted, he was found not guilty. For whatever reason, celebrities tend to get away with tax evasion or that kind of thing. But the world has changed. We're all suffering now. The climate is so bad in terms of cost of living, et cetera, et cetera. We have high expectations now of ourselves, and therefore we have high expectations of those who are taking the proverbial.
Brilliant. Well, that is the end really for this week. Another eclectic mix of chats. I think the thing that it tells us is we constantly go back to people in positions of trust who get away with it and who feel that they are above the law and that the law isn't for them.
I never anticipated when we called our podcast Without Fear or Favour that it would suddenly be what everybody is saying. The law needs to be acting without fear or favour, because people in power, people of wealth, have been getting away with it. And we want to ensure that they don't.
Brilliant. Well, as ever, thank you so much for listening. Please do continue to tell your friends. Let's build our listenership. Drop us an email or contact us via our website. We do like to hear from you. Every single email gets read and responded to. And see us next week. Thank you very much, Nazir. Look after yourself and take care of you and your family.
All the best now. Bye.
Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Do please tell your true crime friends, and it's important that you subscribe to our channel. If you've got any thoughts or you just simply want to get in touch, you can do so via our Twitter page, Fear or Favour, or go to our website, www.fearorfavour.com. The series is edited by Martin Kays, the music by Dylan Epega. Fear or Favour is an original true crime podcast in association with Audioboom.